Hello, and welcome to another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Rita Dunaway here in the studio with my co-host, Dean Welty, for the final installment in our three-part series on the Supreme Court and the Constitution. Now, if you have listened to the previous two programs, hopefully Dean and I have impressed you with the enormous impact the Supreme Court has on the law, public policy, and even the meaning of the Constitution in this modern-day post-truth America. Now, granted, the Founding Fathers certainly never intended it to be that way, but that is the way it is, unfortunately. So today, we are going to discuss President Trump's nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to replace Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and of course, the three-ring circus that is the confirmation proceedings for Judge Kavanaugh. But Dean, I know that everyone listening has already heard quite a bit about that. And maybe some listeners are thinking they're ready to just turn the program off now because, frankly, they've heard all they wanted to hear about that. And that would be understandable. It's become pretty frustrating, disappointing, and discouraging. But we're going to give our listeners something more than just a recap of the process and how it's gone for Judge Kavanaugh. We're going to also be talking today about why and how the process itself has become such a bitter street fight. And we'll think about the questions that should be asked of judicial nominees, not just the way things are going and how bad it's gotten, but why it's gotten that way and what should it be like. Now, Dean, I'm going to suggest we tackle this by starting with the immediate, what's happening now, and then moving on to the ideal. So let's talk first about the nomination process itself.
Well, Rita, thank you. And I just wanted to underscore what you just said. This is bigger than the nomination of Judge Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. This is about the truth and integrity of the Constitution itself, and it's about the soul and spirit of America and the direction that we'll be taking for generations to come.
Yes, it is.
This is that big. And so, yes, we'll be talking about Kavanaugh, but about much, much more.
Right.
Well, Rita, as you know, under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, the president has the sole power to nominate Supreme Court justices. But the nomination must be approved by the U.S. Senate. It must give its advice and consent for this nomination. So the Senate Judiciary Committee, as everybody knows, holds a hearing during which the nominee gives testimony and answers questions from the committee's members. The committee then votes on whether to put the nominee before the Senate. If the committee does report out the nomination, the whole Senate considers it, and a simple majority vote is required to confirm or to reject a nominee. That's the process.
Yeah. Now, we went through this whole process fairly recently with the confirmation of Justice Neil Gorsuch to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. But the situation we're in now has a whole different flavor than that, as I'm sure people have noticed. And the reason why is that with Justice Gorsuch, we had one conservative replacing another conservative. Not a whole lot to really be lost or gained with that. But Justice Kennedy, who will be replaced by Justice Kavanaugh if he is indeed confirmed, has for many years now been a crucial swing vote in some of the most controversial Supreme Court decisions of our time, including Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which of course reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, and Obergefell versus Hodges, which decreed same-sex marriage nationwide. So there is just way more at stake with this nomination, which is part of the reason it's so ugly.
Rita, as we've already suggested, this nomination is so much more important because it reflects an ongoing battle over the meaning and the application of the Constitution itself. Now, how do we see that battle taking shape? On the one side are those who believe that we should interpret the Constitution as it was written and apply it in accordance with the original intent of the framers in 1787. We call them strict constructionists. On the other side are those who believe the Constitution is a living, evolving document that was good for its time, but that judges today can interpret it and apply it differently now in order to remake society in their own image. As Chief Justice Hughes said way back in 1907, the Constitution is what judges say it is. Well, as a result, we have a whole string of Supreme Court decisions, you've mentioned a few, that would have our founding fathers rolling over in the grave. And I'd add to those Supreme Court decisions the one in the early 60s to ban prayer and Bible reading in the public schools. And, of course, as you mentioned, Roe v. Wade decision to legalize abortion in 1973. That is why there is so much controversy over this nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh. He stands at the intersection of these two competing views of the Constitution. And there is a fear, an understandable fear, on the part of liberal activists that he might overturn some of these misguided decisions affecting abortion, same-sex marriage, and religious freedom.
There's a lot more I could say about that, and I think we will get into that a little bit more later in the program. But as far as their fear about some of those precedents being overturned, I would just say if the precedent isn't actually based on what the Constitution really says in black and white, it should be overturned. That is the correct outcome.
Let's get back to the laws of nature and nature's God that is reflected in the Constitution.
Exactly. But before we go further down that road, because that is a long road, Dean, tell us about Judge Kavanaugh. Who is he? What is his reputation as a judge? And what do you think of President Trump's choosing him as the nominee to replace Justice Kennedy?
I think by all accounts, whether they want to admit it or not, Judge Kavanaugh is an outstanding jurist with an impressive legal background. He was born in 1965, about the time you were born, I think. Whoops, I don't know.
Watch it.
He went on to graduate from Yale University and Yale Law School, later taught at various universities, including Yale, Harvard, and Georgetown. He's clerked for several federal court judges, including Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who he would be replacing, later worked as White House Staff Secretary to President Bush, and now serves on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is considered to be the second highest court after the Supreme Court. Now, judging by his record, we would think that he would align himself with the other four strict constructionist judges on the court, giving them the majority on the court.
So that would be Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Roberts.
That is correct. That would give five out of the nine. In addition to this record, the American Bar Association has given him its highest rating of well-qualified for his nomination to the Supreme Court.
And, Dean, that's sort of surprising, isn't
it?
The American Bar Association is an extremely liberal-leaning organization.
And that, by the way, was a unanimous vote. That is remarkable, and that should count for a lot.
I think so.
On a personal note, he's married, has two daughters, attends the Shrine of the Most Blessed Sacrament Church of Washington, D.C., where he serves as a regular lector, helps serve meals to the homeless, and coaches his daughter's basketball team. How's that?
That's pretty good.
So just to summarize, he has an outstanding reputation among other judges, and you ask why President Trump might have nominated him. I can only speculate, but I think it's because of his outstanding judicial record, but it's also to fulfill his, that is Trump's, campaign promise to choose judges who are considered to be strict constructionists. This nomination should not surprise anybody.
I would agree with everything you said about that. I think he is extremely well qualified and it seems like a really wise choice for President Trump. But Dean, it has been absolutely appalling to me to see how contentious, uncivil, and just downright ugly this process has been for Judge Kavanaugh. You know, Scott and I were talking about this morning, and he said, it's amazing to me that any judge would even subject himself to going through this process. And isn't that a shame? that it would be that way.
I agree totally. I watched a lot of the hearings. I was riveted to it, just appalled at what we were seeing on the screen at the behavior.
And then there's all this stuff happening off the screen
exactly.
that you hear reported, and it just makes your jaw drop.
Well, Rita, I want to just add one thing to this assessment, and I think we have to be very clear about this. Most, if not all, of this objectionable behavior at the hearing came from the Democrat side.
Right.
And not from the Republicans. I think that is clear and acknowledged by everybody who was watching. I'll just give a couple of examples. The Democratic senators tried to get Kavanaugh to say how he would vote on some controversial issues that are certain to come before the court. Abortion, same-sex marriage, religious freedoms, for example. Well, it's fair enough to question him. But they knew he couldn't answer those questions. And nevertheless, they continued to badger him hour after hour from every possible direction in ways that were just downright rude. They also tried to get him into a perjury trap, time and time again, asking him questions like, well, have you ever talked with anyone from such and such a law firm? And they insisted on a yes or no answer.
Oh, my goodness.
Even though he said, you have to give me a list. I don't even know who's in that law firm. No, all I want is a yes or no answer.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's that kind of bullying that I think turns so many of us off. But in addition to the uncivil behavior of the Senate Democrats themselves, more than 200 protesters disrupted the proceedings, had to be removed forcibly, and were arrested throughout the 3 days of the hearings.
It's just appalling.
That was orchestrated, and the Democrats knew it and never condemned it.
Now, Dean, I want to ask you about something. I've heard a lot of references back to the confirmation proceedings for Judge Robert Bork, and despite the little comment you made earlier about my age, the fact of the matter is I was not yet paying attention to law and politics back in the 80s. I was probably playing outside with my dolls. But I would be interested in hearing what you remember about that, because, of course, I know a little bit about it. But what do you remember about that, and do you find similarities with what is happening today? And don't tell me you aren't old enough yet.
I'm not going to let you off the hook. I was serving with the United States Embassy in Papua New Guinea at this time. Did I know what was going on?
But, I'm sure you did somehow.
Fortunately, we have Google.
Yes.
So here is perhaps the first similarity. Like Kavanaugh today, Bork would have filled the vacancy left by Justice Lewis Powell, who was considered to be a moderate swing vote on the court, just as Justice Kennedy has been. Bork was clearly more conservative, and the left could not let him be confirmed. That's a similarity.
Yep.
Therefore, the Democrats threw the book at him, just as they are doing to Judge Kavanaugh today. Another similarity. To be specific, Senator Ted Kennedy at the time was the first one to go on the attack, demonizing Bork as they have tried to do with Kavanaugh. And here's what he said. Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions. Blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters. Rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and school children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists could be censored at the whim of the government, and the doors of the federal courts would be shut on the fingers of millions of citizens. Now, does that sound familiar?
Yes.
We're hearing that same thing today.
Fear-mongering.
Fear-mongering. And then, again, as we see today, special interest groups like the NAACP, the ACLU, and People for the American Way piled on as well. As a result, and this is what they're trying to achieve today, Bork was defeated by a vote of 58-42. And in looking back, some have claimed that this marked the end of civil discourse and politics because of the way it was handled. It was so contentious that the word Bork has become a part of the English language as a verb. It means to savage a nominee for public office with the aim of preventing his or her appointment. Again, similar to what we are seeing from the Democrats today against Kavanaugh. In fact, one of the best-known uses of this new word was at a national conference for women against the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas. This is a different case now.
Mm-hmm.
But the lady speaking at that time said, we're going to bork him. Mm. We're going to kill him politically. Again, does that sound familiar?
Yes.
a refrain of what we are hearing today. It is the politics of personal destruction. And that brings us to this second case, if we have time for that. But it's very similar, almost more similar. He was nominated by President Bush in 1991, and like Judge Kavanaugh, he got off to a contentious start with stiff opposition on abortion and civil rights issues. Like Kavanaugh, he was hit near the end of the proceeding with explosive charges of sexual harassment from a University of Oklahoma law professor and a former colleague, Anita Hill. Now, of course, in Kavanaugh's case, it's another professor at a university in California named Christine Blasey Ford. Another example of the politics of personal destruction. Now, in response to those charges, Thomas denied all the allegations, and he referred to the entire process in memorable terms. He called it a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think or do for themselves. You will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree. It's a lynching.
Wow. That's
so
powerful.
Once again, like Kavanaugh, Judge Thomas was seen as moving the court's ideological balance to the right, and that is what prompted the sharp outcry from the left. In the end, he was referred by the committee to the Senate without a recommendation and confirmed 52-48, the narrowest margin for approval in more than a century. Okay, Rita, that's some historical perspective on things that we've seen in the past, very similar to what we're seeing today.
So in a lot of ways, what we're seeing is not new. It's sort of a rehashing of ground that we've been over before.
Yes, but I'd like to go back to your earlier comment about the ugly process itself. I know you've written a couple of commentaries about that. How do you see it?
I think the root of the problem, because that's what I'm always interested in, Dean. What is the root of the problem? You have to understand the problem before you can come up with a solution to it. And I think the root of the problem is that today we have a virtually omnipotent judiciary. As I mentioned earlier, the founders expected the judiciary to be the least dangerous branch of government. That's how they referred to it. They expected the courts to be a neutral arbiter of legal questions according to the written laws adopted pursuant to the political process. But today, that would be a really poor description, I think, of what the court actually does. Thanks to this idea that we live under an organic constitution, which you referred to earlier, Dean, and the meaning changes over time, a lot of federal judges today think that their job is to find some way to twist the words of the Constitution to accommodate changing social values. And as long as we permit those judges to do that, to reinvent the meaning of the words and phrases that frame our government, the political persuasion of the judges is not only relevant, but it is key, because that's going to determine, according to those who ascribe to this theory, that's going to determine the law and public policy that we all live under. Would you agree with that,
Dean? Yes, Rita, I do agree.
Good.
Surprised you, didn't I? In fact, it reminds me of what former Justice Scalia once said about recent trends in the Supreme Court. He said, "It must be living in another world," referring to the court. Day by day, case by case, it is busy designing a constitution for a country I do not recognize. And I'd like to add one more quote. This goes back 300 years to Thomas Jefferson. He said, "The judiciary of the United States is the corps of sappers and miners, constantly working underground to undermine the foundations of our confederated fabric."
Wow. So those are great quotes. And I love the Scalia quote because he talks about the court busy designing a constitution.
Yes, oh dear.
And that just hits the nail on the head, because that's what is actually happening. But of course, that's not what they're supposed to be doing.
There's one way to redesign it, and that's by amendment.
Yeah.
Well,
that's
that
right.
Brings us back to Kavanaugh and what this debate is all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, a court with the power to do all this, to be busy redesigning the Constitution, is guaranteed to be a politicized court. And we are guaranteed to have really ugly fights like we're seeing right now over who will be on it. There's just too much at stake.
As we've already said, what's at stake is the truth and integrity of the Constitution, the soul and spirit of America. We cannot overemphasize that. So how do you resolve it?
One solution that I've thought about is actual constitutional amendment, the legal, legitimate kind of constitutional amendment. I think that our Constitution should say in black and white that courts must strictly construe the enumerated powers of the federal government according to the meaning of the words when they were written. And that while the people's liberties, the Bill of Rights, for instance, should be interpreted broadly, new rights may only be codified by legislatures or added pursuant to Article 5's constitutional amendment process. They may not simply be created out of thin air by the courts. That was never what the courts were supposed to do.
Well, Rita, you're full of good ideas this morning.
Thank you.
But what can actually be done in the meantime until these instructions take hold? Specifically, what questions would you propose that should be asked of every nominee to the court?
Yeah, so tying it to the process that's going on right now. Well, I'm so glad you asked, Dean, because I do have a list here of three questions that I think are crucial to selecting good judges for any court, by the way. So question number one, are you a constitutional realist or a constitutional mystic? And here's what I mean by that. Our legal and academic communities have become so enamored with this idea of a living constitution that changes with the winds of time and popular opinion. And this is a horrible idea and one that has done so much damage to our federal system. The words of the Constitution were not written in magical ink. They don't change, grow, or evolve with the times. If they did, then the Constitution couldn't protect us from the will of judges or the culture that influenced those judges. Judges could simply declare, as many now do, that constitutional words today mean something new and different than what they meant when they were written. Interpreting and applying the Constitution is altogether different from reading tea leaves, and any proper judge and certainly Supreme Court justice must appreciate and respect that distinction. What do you think about that?
I just love that question. I wonder how they will answer it. Are you a constitutional realist or a constitutional mystic? Okay, what's number two?
Well, question number two, is your allegiance to the written Constitution stronger than your allegiance to precedents and your own public policy convictions? Everyone, Dean, seems to be focused on Judge Kavanaugh's views on issues like abortion, gay marriage, or health care. But we have to remember, a judge's role is to interpret and apply the Constitution and laws that were enacted by the people as they are written to the facts of particular cases. A judge's duty is to base rulings on what the law is, never on what he or she thinks the law should be. Precedents based solely on a judge's beliefs should be abandoned. And so that's why it's the symptom, it's the sign of a major problem when we see all this focus on, well, what are your views on this? What are your views on that? It shouldn't matter.
Well, two comments on that, Rita. You said when you were in law school, almost all of your time was in the study of precedents,
right,
not on the original text.
Right.
Stare decisis. Yeah. Has the Supreme Court decisions ever been overturned? What about Dred Scott?
Mm-hmm.
Many cases where the Supreme Court has overturned bad precedents.
Yes.
Okay, Rita, we're getting out of time here.
Okay.
What's number three?
Number three, can you exercise self-restraint in the face of opportunities to orchestrate cultural change? In today's America, Supreme Court justices are celebrities. We learn about their backgrounds, we buy their books, listen to their speeches, because we know how much impact their views will have on the law and policy that governs us. So it is critical for senators to look for personal and institutional humility in the nominees they consider. in the context of so much popular confusion about what it is that the Supreme Court is meant to do, America desperately needs judges who understand their proper role and are humble enough to decline invitations to expand that role by making law and changing policy.
Well, Rita, those are great questions, but I'd like to get back to maybe to some of our personal responsibility for making sure that all of this is done. There are a couple of things I think we can do. We can start by electing a president who has promised that he will appoint strict constructionist judges. We see that happening today. Yep. President Trump has fulfilled a campaign promise, and Judge Kavanaugh is the fruit of that. Secondly, we can show our support to those judges throughout the Senate hearings and throughout their tenure on the bench. On top of that, Rita, and this is a little bit of a sidetrack, in reviewing the Constitution as we've done now for the past 2 weeks, I've been deeply impressed by the ways in which framers applied biblical principles in drafting both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So put this simply, we need to look for judges who have what we call a biblical worldview. They understand the laws of nature and of nature's God. They understand God's gift to us for our inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They understand the self-evident truth that all men are created equal. These are basic principles embodied in our Declaration and in our Constitution that we need to continue abiding by today.
Absolutely. Well, I know that we are almost out of time, but before you have to close, Dean, what would you say to a Christian who takes the attitude that this is all just not particularly relevant to him and it's nothing for him to be concerned about?
That's a great question. I have a dairy farmer relative who won't vote because God is sovereign. And so I ask him, John, who milks your cows in the morning? We have a responsibility, and God has delegated that to us. In Genesis, he created man to have dominion over the whole earth. He calls certain people like Moses to lead his people. In Exodus, God instructed Moses to choose other men who will help him lead the people. They were to be able and honest men who feared God and who were not ambitious for power. Other scriptures refer to government leaders as ministers ordained of God for our good and to punish those who do evil. Therefore, I believe that we as Christians have a special responsibility for our own governance, or if we do not, others will fill the vacuum that we leave behind. Others who do not know God. As Edmund Burke said so famously, evil prospers when good men do nothing. And finally, if we do nothing else, all of us can and should be praying for our leaders as the Bible calls us to do, so that we may live quiet and peaceable lives in all godliness and honesty.
So to sum up, there is a lot of work for us to do.
Amen.
And we do have responsibility, and God is sovereign, and that's why we don't need to get discouraged or depressed, and we don't need to worry. We need to pray and do our part and trust the results to God.
Thank you, Rita. That's a great summary. Well, our time is up, so I want to thank all of our listeners so much for joining us. If you'd like to listen to the program again or share it with your friends, go to our website, valleyfamilyforum.org, and click on the link to Crossroads on the homepage. We also want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services and the dental practice of Scott Dunaway, and to so many of you for your prayers, your encouragement, and your financial support. If you would like to make a tax-deductible donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can do so by check to Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. Again, I'm Dean Welty with Rita Dunaway and engineer Robbie Meadows, inviting you to join us again next week at the Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. Until then, have a great week putting your faith into action.
Rejoice, rejoice, rejoice. Let us rejoice.